thank you. And then, Bill, you want to introduce our speaker for us?
You bet. Paul, you're going to find out, is an amazing guy. He graduated from high school just a couple years ago at the end of World War II. We all remember that, right? And at that time, he joined the Navy and went to boot camp in San Diego. He earned a fleet appointment to the Naval Academy, which sounds pretty, to me, sounds pretty prestigious, but he turned it down. John, you want to introduce him?
No, but I want to say, Paul, I believe he said he was in a boot camp right around the same time as Thomas Monson.
1 year later.
That's right, yeah.
I'll let you go.
No, if you have stuff to add, you've known Paul longer than I have. You should be doing the introduction. But he did turn down the Naval Academy to pursue his childhood sweetheart. They're married. So that's kind of cool. And he also went to the University of Utah to pursue an education in electrical engineering, which you'll hear more about. He had a couple of interesting jobs after that. One was upgrading the nuclear weapons stockpile. And then he left that to start a career in research and development under Arnold Beckman, Dr. Beckman, who we're going to hear more about the subject of his presentation today. And then he and his wife raised a family of four in Fullerton. He served in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a bishop a couple times, I think, and in the Boy Scouts of America. And he retired in 1994, and he lives down in God's country, in sometimes known as San Clemente.
Good place.
So with that, I'll turn the time over to Paul Hansen. Okay.
What is the likelihood that a almost flunked out double E from the University of Utah would be addressing a group of BYU graduates? Some of us. I find out there's one guy here that didn't succumb to that.
There's more than one.
There's more than one.
BYU in those days didn't have much of an engineering department until Harvey Fletcher got there. And besides, I got free rent close to the U, across the valley. I grew up in a little town of Magna that was a mining town. It's where Brigham Young told all the people not to go. They were to stay on the farm and stay out of the mines. Well, that's where my dad ended up as a run machinery to recover metal from ore. I want to thank Bill for this opportunity. He jerked the rug out from under me. By the way, I wanted to talk to you about the types and shadows in your life and how they affect them, because that's been my life study. Now, my present occupation is a caregiver for an Alzheimer's patient, which is my boot camp sweetheart. She's had Alzheimer's, and she's resting in bed. Doesn't get up till 10 o'clock, so I can get back. But she still has her sweet disposition, but her memory retention is 15 seconds. So when I mess up, everything is forgotten in 15 seconds. So, you know, if you feel sorry for Alzheimer's patients, it's been the highest paying job that I've ever had, including working for Dr. Beckman. But the reason I want to thank Bill is he told me that there were some non-members here and that I should refrain from my favorite subject, which is the golden plates, because I've upgraded Mormon's shop to modern equipment and I engrave plates every day. And people ask me when this is going to be over with. And I say, the day I pass away, I can't take this engraving machine with me, so I have to turn it over to my family. But that's expanded greatly from what Mormon had it. But today, he said to focus on a famous person, and the most famous person that I've known is Dr. Beckman. Dr. Beckman, like me, grew up in a small town. Like me, he chased his boot camp sweetheart until he married her. Now, Beckman, I found out, I didn't know Dr. Beckman was a Marine. He never told me that, and I never had reason to discuss it with him. Because when we got together, it was discussing more important things, like, since we have a bunch of lawyers here, lawyers are some of my favorite people. I've had close friendships with lawyers, but they're a peculiar breed. And they're all unique. But my experience, one of my choices experience with Dr. Beckman was explaining why a baby, a premature infant, had died while hooked up to one of our monitors. It's supposed to monitor apnea, which is what they typically call crib death. They stop breathing for a reason that's still unknown. And this device that we had that I was the project engineer over, I inherited it from another guy. I didn't design that junk. But it was working sufficiently well, and we released it. And it was wired to a baby at Anaheim Memorial Hospital. And the baby passed away. And the thing didn't go into alarm. And so you can imagine, you lawyers, what the possibilities of a lawsuit was going to be. So Dr. Beckman called me up personally. All you're going to get down to Anaheim Memorial and find out what's the matter with that instrument. I went down there, took possession of it, and there's nothing wrong with it. The only thing wrong was the nurse wasn't there to hear it. And it had one of these loud, piercing things. When it went into the four-stage alarm, it really... At any rate, I had to draft me and the company physician had to draft a letter written to somebody, probably in the government, explaining the situation. That was the most difficult task I ever had, writing a letter for Dr. Beck. Because he was kind of like a god in this country, in this company. When you said Dr. Beckman, said it in quiet, we never did anything to upset him or embarrass him, because his creed and his motto, I'm not even looking at my notes by now. Those of you who know me know that this is my typical modus of operandi.
When you started working with Dr. Beckman?
I started working in 1960, yeah.
How many?
I don't have any idea, but let me get on with this. I'll get some of the details of some of the company thing. So anyway, we drafted this letter, and so I got to know Dr. Beckman up in personal, and this is kind of midway in my career when this happened. But he was very persnickety. Here's his rules for success. There's no satisfactory substitute for excellence. Absolute integrity is everything. Everything in moderation, including moderation itself. This is my favorite one. Hire the best people and then get out of the way. Don't take yourself too seriously. His goal in life was to give his last dollar away, which he essentially did. His motto was there's always a better way. And so Dr. Beckman got his start in a small town in Illinois. He was born there. And there's a lot of parallels in his life with me outside of marrying our boot camp sweethearts. His dad was a blacksmith. I grew up next door to a blacksmith. My favorite place in the summertime was in the blacksmith shop, watching metal. Metal has become a part of me. It was a part of Dr. Beckman. We used gold and copper to put circuits together to make his instruments work. But this guy was a genius. But he was a different genius. To give you an idea, when he got out of high school, his mother passed away when he was 12. He had three other siblings, all of which graduated from college. And in those days, in that small, rural Illinois town, Cullum is the name of it, it turned out it was only 40 miles away from where my first job as an electrical engineer was. I went to Illinois from Salt Lake Valley. Can you imagine such a thing? I hated it there. I hated the Midwest. I hated the cornfields. No mountains, no streams to fish in. It was terrible. I spent 2 years there and got out. But it was interesting that we both there. When he got out of high school, him and his buddy jumped on a freight train. Visualize this. This is like in 1918, just before World War I. They didn't know where the train was going. They knew it was going west, and they wanted to go west. Somehow, during the jumping on of trains, everybody jumped on a freight train ever before? Don't ever try it. It's not good. They jumped on a train and headed west. And somehow on this train thing, they got on opposite trains. He ended up going to Idaho, and his buddy ended up in Louisiana. So we got this little town in Idaho, Ashton. Now, this is a high school kid. Now, he's a brilliant kid. He got straight A's. I mean, scholastically, he was head and shoulders above everything else. He had a chem lab in his basement. He was researching chemistry and blowing up things and starting fires all the time. His mind was just always focused on what it was that made this thing tick. So he gets up, by the way, learns how to play the piano. And he's convinced in his own mind that he can do anything and overcome and take care of himself, whatever the situation is. So here he is in Ashton, Idaho. I don't know how many have ever been there, but it's not very big. And in those days, it was even smaller. But it had a movie theater, and he made his living playing the piano for silent movies. And he worked all summer there. He loved Ashton. He loved the outdoors. He loved the West. So much so that when he finally got through with all his matriculating at the University of Illinois, where he was a number one student, he was so well thought of, they wanted to put him on the faculty. Okay. He headed west. In his Marine Corps service, he met in New York City a Mabel who was serving at the USO. Very cute, a nurse, and fell in love. And it took him years before they finally got together. He had to go to Bell Labs. He had to graduate from the University of Illinois. He worked at Bell Labs. He ended up at Caltech to get his PhD, which, by the way, they wanted to keep him at Caltech, and he ended up on their board of directors, and he was Mr. Caltech for a lot of years. And I'm going through this. I don't have much time to cover such a man. He was brilliant. But, and all I knew about him, really, was that he invented the pH meter. And I don't know whether you know anything about pH, but we all have blood in our veins, and everything you eat, everything that's manufactured chemically, you go by pH. It's a measure of the hydrogen ion and the content of things, and you can tell whether it's acid or base. And it's the central, if I could center anything in chemistry, pH is one of the most prominent measurements you can make. Well, measuring pH before Beckman, you actually put a little strip of paper that had a dye in it, and you put it in whatever solution you wanted to measure the pH of, and it turned either blue or red or somewhere in between. And you looked at that thing and kind of judged where it was. Well, somebody invented a scale, a pH scale. It goes plus 7 to minus something or other. And so Beckman thought, I've got to make this simpler. So he actually invented an electrode you could dip in the thing and read it out on a meter, an analog meter. By the way, he thought he was an electronic guy. In the electronic business, there's two kinds. There's analog and there's digital. I'm a digital, he was an analog. An analog is a thing that's it's a direct measurement of voltage. a digital guy, you take the analog and you convert it to numbers, which go into a computer, which Dr. Beckman and me spent our lives feeding computers, the computers that eventually ate my job. As memory got cheaper and things got faster, the hardware that I used to develop on the outside migrated right into software. And now look at us today. I got more computers in my ear than Dr. Beckman and I had in our mainframes. That's literally true. And so I was a digital guy in Dr. Beckman's analog business. And he knew he needed me, but he didn't have any idea why. He missed more business opportunities because he didn't understand electronics. And I didn't have access to him to teach him enough to know. And he had smart guys. He had PhD, double E's working on his staff. And they didn't know either. You know, PhD stands for piled higher and deeper. Anyway,
your BS, right?
I don't want to give you the idea that Dr. Beckman and I were bosom buddies. Because he was in one world, and his world consisted of, when he got his PhD from Caltech, some guy came in there, and the reason he invented the pH meter in the first place, some citrus grower, they used to determine when to pick the citrus basing what the pH of the juice was. So you got out a lemon and you squeezed it and you put it in the litmus thing and, you know, and you did all this. So he wanted an easier way to do this. So Dr. Beckman invented the pH meter out of necessity for doing something for a friend. And I don't know what he was making at Caltech, probably $300 a month on their staff. He got his PhD and they wanted him to stay there, so he stayed there and he taught chemistry. But after inventing the pH meter, his life, he always liked money. He had this thing for money. He always had a job. I don't care when it was, in grade school, high school, he always worked. He always had money to buy things. Chemicals to blow up things or to make things. He did his own work as a machinist. He never had a machine. He never had any power equipment, but he did everything else short of that. He blew his own glass. If you've ever been in a chem lab, you gals have ever taken chemistry. I met up a girl up in the U, almost broke up my boot camp sweetheart relationship because she blew up her lab equipment. And Billy and I were on the out, so I started going with her, and her dad was the president of Deseret Book Company. And she wanted to marry me, and I thought I wanted to marry her, but it didn't work out. My parents were delighted. Her dad and President McKay were like this. They went to his birthday party. So my parents were elated that I was going to actually marry somebody in that status. But I ended up marrying the alcoholic butcher's daughter. That's a little side issue. But anyway, Dr. Beckman, after he invented this pH meter, he saw a way to make some money. Because he said, you know, probably I could make these pH meters, and there's probably maybe 50 people that would buy them. And I could probably sell these things for so many dollars. And he compared those dollars with what he was making teaching chemistry, and making the pH meters look pretty good. So in his garage, he made two or three more of these things. They were gone like this. He thought, wow, maybe there's more opportunity here. Long story short, he ended up starting a company making pH meters. And I thought he moved that company down to the Fullerton area in the middle of a bunch of orange groves because he needed more space because there was such a demand for this thing. But what I didn't know and what I found out reading the book that you forced me into reading, that he had He knew Albert Einstein. He knew Jim Sternberg. Not Jim Sternberg. Jim, can't think of his name. The inventor of DNA.
Watson.
The double helix.
Watson. It's on the cover here, actually.
And I was going to read you the foreword by him. James, you know, when you get old, you know a lot, but the access to names is, yeah, Jim Watson, Cold Harbor. He was the guy that came up with a double helix. I heard him talk at Beckman Institute down at UC Irvine. And a little spiritual aspect to this. Here's this guy, James Watson, who is, to the biological chemist, God himself. They didn't believe in God, but here was God giving them a talk towards the end of his career. He was now a world's famous scientist, inventor of DNA, which is a popular thing. All you lawyers get to use it in a courtroom as evidence, know the importance of DNA, and we know it even in our genealogical research. It's great. So here he gave this talk, and at the end of his talk, you know what he said? And I'll never forget this. Dr. Beckman was there. He was getting pretty old at those days, but he was there. He announced to the thing all the wonderful things, where it was going. They were doing the research and compiling all the data, which, by the way, we were doing a DNA sequencer at Beckman Instruments. While the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, I was working with scientists doing that. Electronics gets you into all kinds of things. And he announced to them that there is some essence that's much finer than DNA. DNA is just a molecule in a cell, which is pretty, I can almost see that in my microscopes. But there is an essence. And for lack of a better word, it is God. And this group of scientists in there, world scientists gathered, let out an audible, ah. They had just been told that there was an essence that was finer than that. Now, Dr. Beckman, going forward, I got 3 minutes to summarize this thing.
You got a little more.
I got a little more time. He decided that he would break ranks and join the world of business. Now, he knew a lot of things, but he was a terrible businessman. But he was an honest man, and he always hired the best. And once he hired you, he expected you to do your job, and he relied on what you told him. He got a lot of bad advice. These people were well-intentioned, I'm sure. Some from lawyers, some from businessmen, some from other professors. None of which were very business-oriented. But anyway, he started this business. And one of the things that he went through from a pH meter was a spectrophotometer. And I don't know whether you know much about spectrophotometry, but it's every material known to man emits light or absorbs light. And so you can tell by the light emanating from things like the sun or reflected light from the planets. You run that through a spectrophotometer, which is a prism which breaks the light into its spectral colors. You've all seen these prismatic things. And by measuring the intensity of the light in each one of those colors, you can tell what the substance is, and every substance has its own spectrum. It's like a fingerprint. So he made these spectrophotometers. Well, he knew right away, he knew a lot of the chemistry behind that, but he didn't know the mechanism, how to do all the optics necessary to do this. And so we hired somebody. And if you can believe, here's Orville Beckman. He hired Wilbur Kay. So we have Orville and Wilbur in this company. And I got to know Wilbur. I sat in the office next to him for a number of years during our wind-down years. And he was a character, too. And so that was one of the instruments that he brought south into the lemon groves in Fullerton. And these were complex things. And I ended up working on projects developing spectrophotometers. Beckman Instruments was comprised of a number of different divisions. As he came up with a new device, it would start a division dedicated to that, the manufacture of that. And the manufacturing got to be intense. He knew nothing about manufacturing. Mass manufacturing in a big way. So the company of a half a dozen people, at the time I joined, it was about 6,000 people. It got up to be 10,000 people, and it's now down to 800.
See, half a dozen when you joined?
Huh?
Half a dozen when you joined? Six people when you joined?
When I joined?
Yeah.
Oh, there were 6,000. It was a pretty good-sized company and going pretty well. And it's kind of interesting how I got there. I got to California because of the atom bomb. I went to work at Sandia Corporation. In those days, the war was over, and we were deciding how to make the bombs bigger. And we were negotiating with the Russians on what the limit of these bombs were going to be, and they decided it would be 50 megatons. 50 megatons. The thing they dropped on Hiroshima was 25 kilotons, to give you an idea. Well, I was in Albuquerque and going to church there, and one of the guys in our church group was a blast effects guy studying the effects of nuclear explosions. And they found out that anything bigger than 50 megatons just blew a hole in the atmosphere and you didn't get any kill. So there was no reason to make anything bigger than 50 megatons. Buried in the hills around the country, we had 100 megaton weapons in those days. And so I got assigned to a group developing a device that you bolted on to an existing weapon that doubled the yield. It was the size of a lunch bucket. My job was to calibrate this thing to make sure we had all the stuff that are stored in the hills, and these weapons has to be tested periodically to make certain that if we had to use it, it would go bang. And it's a very complex thing to make a thing go bang, let me tell you, very complex. And so my job was to calibrate this thing. I had to go to Los Alamos up there to accelerator, so I was working with some high-powered physicist from the University of California at Berkeley, run the labs. I worked for a company there. My job was to calibrate this thing, and in order to calibrate it, I needed an electronic counter. And so I didn't have the facility there to do it, to manufacture enough of them to do it, so I put out a bid, and Beckman Instruments got it. And so that's how I met the people at Beckman. They thought I was a pretty smart engineer. And so when they needed people in California to man a ground station for a satellite system. By the way, this is in 1960, guys. They had spy satellites going over the Soviet Union taking pictures and measuring infrared sources. And I actually did the ground station, the electronics, to talk to the satellite. And so they ended up hiring me. They were desperate. I didn't want to leave New Mexico. I love New Mexico. There were mountains, there were streams with trout in them. They had everything. But they finally convinced me to go there. And that's how I got there. So the bomb got me to Southern California, working for this crazy scientist who think he could do everything. I'll just end with one thing. One of my jobs when I was down at UCI, I got out of Fullerton for a while, and went down there. And he had an office up in one corner of the building. He was retired. He was giving his millions away. Mabel had passed away. He was a lonesome old guy. And I would talk to him once in a while. And anyway, I was involved in a project there developing a state-of-the-art piece of electronics that had to be liquid-cooled to keep it functioning. Use liquid nitrogen in this cockeyed thing to keep it cool enough. Very complex, working with a professor at UC Arizona. And he was giving a lecture to a bunch of the top people, including Dr. Beckman, in our lab. And he got through with that, and we're walking back to our offices, and Dr. Beckman come up to me, and he says, Paul, he said, you know, I didn't understand a thing those fellas had to say. But that's Dr. Beckman. And so I guess the bottom line of all this, and I kind of salute BYU, the only reason the U ever contacts me is to get money. And the guys that call me posing as engineers are actually in the business administration part of the U, and they just want my money. They don't care about what I did, what I'm doing. By the way, I got advice from the dean of the College of Engineering, not the dean of the electrical department, dean of the College of Engineering, in my junior year to drop out of engineering because I would never become an electrical engineer. So I can hardly wait to meet Dean Taylor and compare our careers. I'm the second guy I want to meet after I meet Moroni and Mormon is Dr. Beckman, to make sure that he's approved what I've said about him here today. Because I'm sure he's ranting and raving, but deep down, he was a decent, honest man. But you know, I wasn't smart enough then, even though I was bishop during part of those years, during all of those years, as a matter of fact, to introduce him to the gospel. I didn't know enough. I didn't know how to go about it. I do now. And I'm sure that he's a decent enough guy that he and Mabel are probably waiting for somebody to do their temple work for him. But I would just like to thank him for the courage he had to start that business and the tenacity to keep it going through some pretty trying times. I've just given you one instance of the baby dying on the monitor, but there were many more equally challenging things that we went through, where I'd get a call from Dr. Beckman, and he says, Paul, you need to go back on the Ohio River to an acid plant back there that's being sued $10,000 an hour for dumping effluent into the Ohio River where the pH is not neutral. And I had designed a controller that was supposed to be controlling, neutralizing that acid before it went into the river. And so $10,000 an hour, I was on my way back there to find out what was the matter with my controller because it wasn't being controlled. And just like the other instrument, the controller was fine. It was the mechanical design of the mixing thing. You know, it turned out to be a machine shop building thing more than a scientific electronic thing. Electronics usually come out of it pretty good. And so I hope, Dr. Beckman, you're happy with this. And do any of you have any last-minute questions before you need to bail out? I know a lot of you are still working. How many here are still working? Well, the real estate guys, you can work up till you die.
That's true. But I don't want to do that.
Electronic engineering just went out the window. The computer ate my job. I doubt if they'll ever eat your job.
That was riveting.
Huh?
Thank you.
I think Dr. Beckman would be very, very pleased with
that. Oh, by the way, your new venue down there?
Yeah.
Right up on Baraka Parkway, just across the 5, is a place called... can't think of their name, but they manufacture engraving machines. the world's best. They have a facility there that you have to knock on the front door to go in, but they have one each of everything they make. And they make some fantastic things. But sometime I would like to do a plate fireside in that facility if I can arrange it. And this will blow the socks away of all the Mormons and the people who have known Mormons or know anything about golden plates. And it's right there where you're just across from the spectrum.
I think it's just right down in Irvine Center Drive. I think I know exactly where.